Hello, and welcome to the Roundtable Discussion on the Comic Per Page podcast. My name is John Mayo. In this episode, I'm joined by my sister, and we're going to have a spoiler-filled discussion on the book Predictably Irrational by Dan Ariely. This was the basis used for the show The Irrational. This book was published in June 2009.
Now, we're reading the updated and revised edition.
Updated and revised edition. I don't know...
I think the original edition came out in 2004 or 2005, just based on what the text says about, you know, recent results, say 2004, this, that, the other.
This is the kind of book I was reading a couple of way back when, around, I want to say 2007 to 2010-ish, thereabouts, maybe a little before, a little after. I was doing the sales numbers, and it's kind of, why do people do what they do? The concepts of the paradox of choice, too many options, and no, you don't buy anything.
Yeah.
That kind of a thing. And what got me intrigued about this book is it's the basis for the show, but it's not a fiction book. It's a guy basically telling, hey, I'm a behavioral scientist. Here's some studies we've done. Here's what we took out of the studies. But I also think the show is a very faithful, I don't say adaptation, but They pulled the right things out of the book.
Yes, I agree with that.
Because the character in the show is very different than the author, but how he thinks, how he, hey, let's put a study together for that, I think this, and it's got the same vibe to it.
I'd say even the character's backstory has a similar vibe.
Oh, definitely. There's differences on the what led to the burns and all of that, but a lot of the key backstory elements are kind of there.
Yeah.
They clearly read this, and I can see where they said this would make for an interesting protagonist of a procedural, and here's how it would spin the story and why. And I can also see, and we talked about this on episode about the show, where they were at the pilot and then how they subtly tweaked the character a little moving forward.
Well, and often when we see a movie, a TV show, whatever, that says based on the book, bye, and I go look at it, it's a novel, and I'll start reading the book, and the changes are so wildly different.
Well, Private Eyes, based on the book The Code.
Yes.
The Code was just a minor thing in the book. It was almost incidental. And arguably, it was incidental in the show, too, but it took on a different life, a different aspect to it.
Well, it's funny, because, and I forget what it was, but there was something where, you know, based on a novel, I go pick up the novel. The novel is set in the 1980s. The show is a very here and now show, so you've got a character who lives on their cell phone. Reading a novel in the 80s, where cell phones are not even a dream yet, the character's behavior is so different.
Yeah, yeah.
That it was disorienting to me. So for me, they were just two drastically different things. And once I put that in my head, I could enjoy each as two drastically different things. But with this, as I was reading it, I was like, I get it. I really think they did pull this guy, and I see what intrigued them about both this guy and his methods for understanding people.
Yeah, and I can see where they read this and were inspired to do the show based on it. Whereas there have been other times I've seen the show or the movie, I've looked at the book, and I'm like, how did they get from there to there?
Yeah.
It just, it boggles the mind. That's the great mystery of some of the shows. Boggles the mind, certainly. Here, there were definitely a few things I really enjoyed about the book, other things less so, and a few things that just drove me a little nuts. But the basic gist of the book is people do things that on the surface just seem completely crazy and like, why are they doing that? But there's a rhyme and a reason sometimes if you look at it from the right angle, or there are certain things that drive our behaviors of things we're either drawn towards doing or avoiding. And he and other behavioral scientists have done various studies to try to understand when something is free, how does that influence behavior versus if it's a penny, 50 cents, a dollar or something. The concept of price anchoring.
Yeah.
Once you get that a particular price in your mind for something, if it's cheaper than that, that's good. Whether you think it's worth that or not, it's kind of you've locked in on thing and now you've got to be budged from that position.
Yes.
There are a number of things of that sort that when he's walking through, here's the study we did and here's what we took out of it, I found fascinating. But whenever you read a book like this, or really hear, whenever you read or hear about any study of, well, studies show that people are going to act this way at this point for this reason, there are a couple of questions you got to ask. How big was the study?
Yes.
And how much of it is interpretation of the study? Because this is a book where it's easy to do a chapter, stop, think about it, read the next, not necessarily cover to cover in one sitting.
And that was actually my preferred way to read it.
Yeah. So it took me a little while to go through this. And we've had a couple of times to kind of chat about aspects of the book. And there was one study they did that was really around credit cards, credit card fees, and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And the author's take was, seemed very much that the credit card fees are a little predatory because once they kick in, it's not only for what you're going to...
Well, it was twofold.
Retroactive and forward kind of double dinging.
Right. Well, his attitudes were twofold. First of all, people get suckered by the concept of free.
Yeah.
Free annual fee.
It's the free annual fee and versus and the interest rate.
And then the high annual percentage rate when you don't pay in full every month. And then he blatantly says, because nobody pays in full every month. Yeah. I beg to differ.
Yeah. I pay my credit card every month in full. And there have been one or two times I have not. Either the bill didn't come or something else unusual happened.
Yeah.
And that's when that interest rate kicks in and it's nasty.
Yes.
But the assumption that nobody ever does this, therefore getting that free yearly fee is for suckers.
Yes. And then what you're referring to, which he talks about near the end of the book, and was saying that they actually were passing rules to deal with, is, and this is particularly bad on cash advances, which I think a lot of people don't realize, is the moment that you don't pay the bill and that APR hits, it's not from the day you didn't pay the bill. It's from the day the charge hit the credit card.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's in the fine print.
You're essentially forgiven that if you pay it on time, but it's secretly accruing if you don't.
With cash advances, it's accruing from the day you get the cash advance.
Yes, because you've got the money at that point.
Regardless of if you pay on time or not. So if you get a cash advance and you pay the amount of the cash advance on time, you still have a bill for interest.
Yeah. But this is one of those things where there was a line in the book where he's saying, pull up the exact quote. It was one of the few things I highlighted. There have been most books, I'm too lazy to highlight things. There have been one or two I've highlighted a lot, but typically it's only for things that really stick out. Let me, it's the joy of the Kindle. Okay. The quote is, and this is on page 304, if anyone cares. There's another sinister impression that I took out of our studies. And when I read this to you before we started recording, and you're like, and?
What's the sinister impression what I was going for.
That's not the point. The point is, there's another impression that I took out of our studies.
Yeah.
It's not just how many people did they do. They did 30, they did 100, they did whatever. Because a lot of this is students on the MIT campus or at this other college or they've replicated it elsewhere, whatever. But once they've got that, they have to interpret the results. We saw this behavior, therefore it must mean this. And there was one that they did and it had already kind of piqued my interest because it was based on a restaurant outside of the University of Chapel Hill.
Yes.
Which our dad had gone to. So I'm like, okay, I'm curious. Having a sample set of two that happened to be brothers separated by 8 years, decades and decades ago. So obviously I was well informed. Anyways, the study was they had been to informal sit down kind of a restaurant thing. And they were wondering, well, what studies could we do based on this? So what they decided to do was see how people behave when ordering food and drink.
See if their behavior is changed if they order aloud / publicly.
Yep. Or privately by writing it down.
Yeah.
Because the idea was the first person it's not going to make any difference for. But afterwards, you're now ordering either the same thing if you're in a conformist culture, because somebody did these studies overseas, in which case somebody orders, you know, the burger and soda. Well, that's the in choice. I'll do that. But other, you know, here in the States, well, somebody staked that out. I'm going to be independent. I'm going to prove I can think for myself. I'm going to get something else, even though I'd really rather have that. So they did that study in terms of, did they order aloud, and therefore earlier people's order influenced other people's order, and then did they enjoy the meal?
Well, this was alcoholic beverages at a pub.
You're right. It was the beverages, and I've got to drink something different to yes. show I'm an independent thinker or something.
And I do wonder, since you're bringing the concept of food in, I do wonder, because he does mention food later, but I do wonder if alcoholic beverages is a different situation than meals.
I think it is, but not being a drinker myself, I can't tell you how. But there were assumptions baked in that people, they're worried about how they're perceived and therefore acting in accordance. And there seemed to be no concept of, was the drink really any good or not?
Yeah.
Because there was a few others where it's like, oh, we primed people in a particular way, gave them a quiz, and the three groups, the control, the one we primed to cheat, the one we primed not to cheat. The control group got, on average, 4 out of 10 correct. The next group were able to cheat a little. They said they got 5 out of 10. The ones that could cheat entirely because there was no accountability, they cheated 7 out of 10, or whatever the results were. Clearly, you know, they're saying, well, we had our control group, therefore 4 is the number of answers we can expect out of it.
Everybody in every group was equally smart, we assume.
Yes.
One of the experiments they did, it was, does money versus a money substitute to be exchanged for money, a token, matter? And you got your token, you took it 12 feet away to someone within sight of the person who gave you the token and exchanged it for the money.
If abstracting money to tokens, does it increase essentially cheating or theft?
And what I wanted to know on that one, and that they didn't do, was, would the amount of cheating change if you got your token and instead of walking 12 feet across the same room and being within sight of the people giving you the token?
Oh, if it was the next room or down the hall or something? Yeah.
If it was out of sight of the person who gave you the token, would that influence how much cheating was done?
Well, and I think when they do these studies, somebody's always going to take it and say, well, that's a good point. Let's do another study and test for that or whatnot. And it's hard to have the controls in place, i.e. all other things being equal, we'll assume they would have gotten 4 out of 10 questions correct. Anything other than that is clearly cheating. It's like, well, can't you set up a room for them to do this in where you can actually kind of peer over their shoulder or something and find out if they actually are cheating?
Yeah.
So there are a number of things where the assumptions being baked into the interpretation of the data kind of irked me a little. And I am not a behavioral scientist. I have not done any of these sorts of studies in any kind of academic sense. I don't know what they actually tried to do either back when this book was written or today to account for those things. Because there were a couple of times where it's like, okay, here's the questions we gave and gave some of the information. I assume for an academic paper, for peer review, they're not only giving the methodology, well, but also publishing the results.
Yeah, he does say at the end that he took this out of academies.
Yes, he simplified it for the common man.
Well, at one point, he gives the math questions. And I'm like, either I'm not understanding the questions, or I'm getting 8 out of 10 just by glancing at it. And you're saying most people got 3 out of 10, and I'm not that smart. So am I not understanding the questions?
There was some of that, and there's, okay, you're doing this at MIT, or you're doing it at Harvard, or you're doing it at, you know, whatever.
I want to know, upon acceptance at MIT, do you sign some kind of thing that says, I acknowledge I may be experimented on when walking across campus or eating in the cafeteria?
I know you don't, at least at most colleges. But I think if you've ever been in a psychology course,
yes,
you quickly realize if you see somebody with a clipboard, run the other way.
Yeah, pretty much. Now, I could have sworn he said that he's a behavioral psychologist. From my perspective, And I took psychology and sociology the same semesters in college. A lot of people told me that was a bonehead move. I actually found it fascinating. Mm-hmm. From my perspective, a lot of this was from a sociological perspective, not a psychology perspective.
Well, but it was also using the standard economic theory as the straw man of, well, if people behave rationally, clearly they'll do this.
Yeah.
And hence the predictably irrational title of the book, and never really entertaining the notion in the book of something may seem irrational if you look at it from one perspective.
Yeah.
But if you look at it from another angle or through another lens of different goal, different mindset, whatever, it's perfectly rational.
Well, a lot of his experiments, from my perspective, didn't take into account, are you living on a budget?
Well, the experiments he did with Halloween candy were clearly the better answers to get the bigger piece of candy. Well, we had times where our parents said, well, you have one piece tonight. So you're actually better off with multiple pieces, even if they're smaller.
Yeah.
Because you can have more candy longer.
Yeah.
So again, different metric, different what's better.
Well, and in our house when we were kids, you came home from trick-or-treating and everybody put all their candy out in piles, and then it was one-for-one trades.
So you can pick the candies you like versus getting stuck with the ones you don't. But it's all a matter of perspective, and there was an aspect of this book where there was a one-size-fits-all, and the value of the study depended on the biases of the people interpreting the results. And I don't mean that as a negative. I mean that as a be aware of that whenever you hear about any study and all of that. Again, how big was it? What's the data actually say? And do you interpret the data the same way the people who ran the study did?
They did a study on placebo effects of medications. Mm-hmm. I wanted to know, and they didn't include it in their study, because they had the, okay, we give you the medication and we tell you it's a very expensive medication and it'll work within 15 minutes. We give you the medication, but we tell you it's been discounted to really cheap and it'll work in 15 minutes. What they didn't offer people was a, we give you the medication and we tell you don't take it till you need it, but the moment you take it, it'll kick in and work.
Or tell them, we've got this, but it may have this side effect that it doesn't. And do you get the side effect placebo?
Yeah.
Aspect? I mean, there's, again, multiple studies that could be done. And I'm sure more have been done that obviously were covered in the book.
Well, the reason I wanted to know about the give it to them, but discourage them, basically, from taking it until they needed it, is because I've found with people on the cruise ships we go on, with the seasickness medications.
Mm.
The people who are told, you know, put the patch on the moment you board so you don't get seasick, because otherwise you'll get seasick and it's too late to put the patch on if you put it on when you're seasick. They put it on the moment they board. They keep wearing the patches consistently throughout. They don't know it interacts with alcohol. They don't know the negatives. A lot of people get sick from it and have bad times. And then they get off saying, the only reason I didn't get seasick is because I wore that patch the whole time.
Well, and there's the, this happened, therefore it was because of this.
Yeah.
Again, prejudice, bias, whatever you want to phrase it as.
Seasickness medication I take with us, and I encourage other people to take with them, is a wonderful medication that you don't take until after you're seasick, and you only take if you need it. Since I started taking that with us, I haven't needed it the past 5 or 6 cruises.
But there is an aspect of placebo effect there of, I know I have it if I need it.
Yeah.
Therefore, I'm less likely to need it.
Exactly.
I think there's a lot to be said for trying to understand how people think, for running experiments to test different variables and such. But again, that trick is figuring out the question you're trying to answer, to put a series of tests around it, to kind of cover happy path, unhappy path, positive case, negative case, border case, whatever, and to not read too much into the results that aren't actually there. And I really felt like there were a number of times here where the author's mindset prejudiced the results.
I came out of this book feeling like we were probably taught and or raised differently than a lot of people, because there were a lot of things that both his people he experimented on as well as him came into it with just a different mindset than I have.
Mm-hmm.
And like on the placebo experiment, I felt the results were out of date. And by that, I simply mean the book is 15 years old.
Yeah.
And now...
Well, and the study wasn't done the minute the book was written.
Exactly. So the experiment is probably 20 years old. But now so many people have health insurance. And like, I know when mom gets a prescription and I get a prescription for the exact same medication, frequently the amount we will pay for the same number of pills of the same dosage can be $20 or $30 different.
Well, and there's also a lot of health cares that push towards the generic.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a bias kind of against the generic.
Yes.
So clearly that's going to be seen as lesser than.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there were a number of things that did feel a bit dated. And part of that is, again, the book was published about 15 years ago. He had to spend a little time writing it. The experiments were done prior to that in some cases. I mean, he talks about doing them at multiple places. So his career has obviously gone on for a number of years.
Yeah.
Some of these studies could be easily a quarter of a century old. And that's, again, nothing wrong with that. But there are certain things that people would have reacted to one way 25 years ago and today very differently because of changes in society and the way, I think in some cases, we're a more educated culture in some respects, and there are different options available to us today.
Yeah.
So, again, while I have some issues with some of the experiments, some of the results, etc., he did a good job kind of outlining what they were thinking, what they were trying to test for. Whether I agree with all their methodology or specifics or whatnot is almost besides the point. That aspect was very much carried into the show well.
Yes.
And I can see somebody coming out of this thinking, if somebody is thinking along these lines, how could you apply that to the procedural format on TV?
I will say the book explained to me why something I do works as positive, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
And that is when we go on vacations, we go on the cruises, everybody else is handing out the cash tips at the end as the added bonus beyond what the crew has paid and stuff. I hand make a personal gift.
Yeah.
And he has some really interesting stuff in here about gift versus pay.
Well, and social norms versus, what was the other phrase used for it?
Like market norm.
Market norms. Mm-hmm. And once you've crossed from social norms of, hey, I'm doing you a favor, you're going to want to repay it back, to I'm giving you a couple of bucks for this.
Yeah.
Now we're in a market economy.
Yeah.
And it really changes the nature of things. I thought that was very interesting mm-hmm. and insightful.
Yeah.
And he's got a thing near the end on, again, going back to the cash, replacing it with tokens, the impact of that on ethics and all of that. And that's where one of the places I really felt the book was woefully out of date, because since this book has hit, we've hit the pandemic, we've come out of the pandemic, we're a much more cashless society than we used to be.
I would love to see that final section where he does the tokens and everything explored in a short book with, okay, when did people start going to the restaurant in the hotel and charging it to their room?
Yeah, if he or somebody were to take kind of the concepts of those final chapters and when did store credit come about?
Yes, that was the 60s. Well, in different forms. I mean, in the 1800s, you started.
That's the kind of thing I'm talking about. The tab, that kind of a thing.
Yeah.
When did credit cards come around? When did checking accounts come around? Put it on my room bill.
Mm-hmm.
And how have all of those things been abused?
Yeah.
What kind of protections have had to be put against them? How has that impacted
the
way society can operate and how people behave?
I wonder if when people started putting meals on their room, both as individuals and for professionals on work trips, if they started spending more on meals.
In some cases, yeah, and stuff. It's interesting, though, because I took a business trip once where, because it was a short business trip, we were doing a team meal, my expense for the trip, honestly, was like $12 or something.
Mm.
And it's like, you were there for a couple of days. How? It's like, well, you know, I didn't really have anything at the airport. had stuff at the office, but that was kind of covered by somebody, you know, or
yeah.
It was on the company credit card. So I didn't really have anything else to expense for. I've had others where I've had times where I literally had, I want to say $10,000 almost on my personal credit card that I was waiting to get, expense yeah. back.
Now, I can do you one slightly better. Way back in the dark ages, when there weren't rules about fraternizing with coworkers, I was dating a coworker. He and I are on the same business trip, and we have a $25 a day stipend. So we figured out how to go to Jack in the Box for 99-cent tacos for lunch, and then have $48 between the two of us.
Yeah.
To go out, and we were alternating. One of us would do $48 and the other the next day. And then one of us had a receipt to turn in on alternating days.
Well, to me, there's a question of, are we talking about ethics or are we talking about gaming the system? Because it not necessarily being wrong. I mean, if you're allowed to do that, you're allowed to do that.
Well, our receipts totaled up to $50 every 2 days. It's just one of us was spending it the first of the 2 days, the other was spending it the second of the 2 days.
My point is, there are some people that say, oh, you're cheating the system. Others are going to be, you're operating within the rules of the game.
And the manager in question said, I'm only allowing this because you're operating within the rules. We're like, if we're operating within the rules, why is there a, I'm only allowing this because?
Why is there an, I'm allowing it because?
Yeah.
The rules say I can do this, therefore I'm able to do this.
Yeah.
And I think that's the social norm, market norm kind of a thing. You've put rules and numbers around it. We're now in a market norm.
Yeah. And it was a turn in your receipts at the end of the week, and they can only total this much, which is divides out to $25 per day. And that's how it was phrased to us.
You're given this allowance and you spend it as you wish,
mm-hmm.
versus the manager was treating it as a social norm.
Yeah.
And treating it as if you were trying to cheat the system. And I think that disconnect, because I always try to be responsible not only with my money, but the company I'm working for's money.
Yes.
And I've had times early in my career, admittedly, where the company paid more for my travel than for me. And that always felt a little weird, but it seems irrational. But if they need me there, it's within, they're willing to pay it and all that stuff, it's okay. I mean,
I had a job where the company paid more to rent my car from me than they yeah. paid me to work that day.
Again, there are things that on one hand seem absolutely insane, but when you understand the perspective that it was kind of driven from,
yeah,
it makes sense. And I think there's a lot to be said for, because one of the courses I took early in college was an ethics course.
Mm.
And it was fascinating to me on a number of levels. I took it because the two professors that were team teaching it, I had had already, one for logic and one for advanced logic.
Mm.
And it's like, okay, this is a, you know, philosophy thing. It's ethics and stuff. It's interesting. It was also a required course for business majors. And they taught it at like the 1 o'clock and 2 o'clock sessions on, I think it was like Monday, Wednesday. And then there was a discussion group one, like the Thursday or whatever. Have the midterm. We go in. Now, one of the two professors was a much better lecturer than the other. Both were smart guys, good guys, enjoyed the classes from both. The better lecturer comes in after the midterm, and it was one of them, if you want to take it at 1 o'clock, take it at 1 o'clock. If you want to take it at 2 o'clock, take it at 2 o'clock. We've got two sessions. We don't really give a damn. Just take the test.
Yeah.
Well, in one of the sessions, it was an auditorium room that sloped pretty severely. And the acoustics are set up, obviously, to where the lecturer at the bottom can speak and be heard up at the top. People up at the top can speak and not be heard by the lecturer, just the acoustics yeah. of the room. Well, after the midterm, better lecturer comes in and basically announces that the out of the 40 questions, the high score was a 32, the low score was a 16, and 30 some odd percent or whatever the percentage was caught cheating for an ethics class.
Gosh.
Apparently what had happened is in that auditorium room, professors were out, the teachers put the test down, come in, take them, go up, fill it out, give us your answers back. Some people took it and walked out of the room at the 1 o'clock, looked it over, and turned it in at the 2 o'clock. Which, again, ethics course and you're cheating, mind blown.
Yeah.
And still not getting a great grade.
Yeah.
Hilarious. Of course, it was funny because I, for various other reasons, I had some other courses in the same building as the philosophy department and stuff. Was in the hallways with them. I forget exactly where, why, or whatever. And subject kind of comes up. And, oh, yeah, I remember when you mentioned the, you know, X percent of the class was cheating or whatever. And he's like, but they work. I know, but it's funny.
I know, right? Yeah.
But the whole bit on cashless leading to more abuse of the system, more theft, more dishonesty as we're moving to a more cashless society.
Yeah.
He mentions that as a caution. It's like, okay, follow up on that.
Yeah.
And just trying to understand how people think, why they do what they do. I'd like to see books that go into, because I've worked with a couple of people who will say things for, in my opinion, the explicit intent to evoke a reaction, to get a rise out of somebody,
mm-hmm.
to stir things up.
Yeah.
And I'm at the point where life's too short for that. Shut the hell up. Go away. But I'd like to understand, why do they do that? Why do they need to see that reaction? And there's some people who do it in an inoffensive way. There are others who do it to embarrass people, to humiliate people, to
mm-hmm.
insult people. Obviously, I have less interest in that. And this book, again, uncovered the people are going to avoid the sense of loss, which, again, had the ridiculous, in my opinion, suggestion of, oh, if you routinely go out to eat with a bunch of people, instead of splitting the check, because that's hard, nobody likes that, just have, you know, if there's four of you, you go out once a month, person A pays the first week, B the second week, C the third week, D the fourth week, it's all good. It's actually better for you because, I mean, people feel an emotional pain when they pay the bill, but it's not linear. You pay $25, you feel X amount of pain, you pay $50, you feel, you know, X 0.2% pain, yeah. You know, whatever. I mean, it's not twice as much for twice the bill. Therefore, if only one person has the pain, it's less shared pain. And I'm like, there is no way that would work in most cases.
Well, the assumption that any given week you have enough in your wallet to pay four times.
That you could pay for four people, that you trust the other three people not to, well, I know I'm not paying this week, ergo, I'm going to get the expensive thing. Because he never did any study as to how do people order when they know that.
Yeah.
And given the studies he did on dishonesty, cheating, and all the other stuff,
yeah,
and ordering based on, you know, when you know what other people are getting and stuff, my assumption based on his research would be the week I'm paying, they're going to buy more than they would have if they knew they were paying.
Mm-hmm.
And again, can you afford the four times what you would normally pay, or are you able to budget, I can spend X amount per week, or throttle up or down based on how you're doing that week?
Well, and his experiment on how people meet deadlines. Do they need them imposed by someone else? Do they meet deadlines they set? Are they realistic when they set deadlines for themselves?
Yes. And I would love to see that revisited in today's age where there are so many like YouTube channels and books on personal productivity and all of that. And how do those systems really pan out? What's the studies suggest on that?
And better calendar apps than there were 20 years ago.
More calendar apps. I don't know if I would say better or not, because things like the Getting Things Done system, not that it was an app, but there were other apps, as you know, in 2009 or even prior to that with the Palm Pilot and Blackberries and the day planners that go further back. But that's one where taking the different systems, having people apply them, do they work, do they not? But with this kind of an author, I would expect to get the one-size-fits-all answer. This system was bad. Well, wait. Take 20 students. For five of them, it may be a horrible system, but for two of them, it may be the best system.
Going back to my he seems to generalize across American society.
I don't even think he limits it to American society. There was only the one case where he mentioned in places where there's a more conformist culture, like in Asia, the ordering will reflect that.
Well, he commonly said Americans this, that, the other.
Fair enough. Fair enough. He does generalize. And again, that's my point on the biases on interpreting the data. There can only be the one answer. And that was something when I was analyzing the sales number. I mean, I think there are certain things that are a controlling factor, but by no means an exclusive factor.
Yeah. Well, earlier when you were mentioning the difficulties of choice, I deal on a regular basis with someone entering dementia.
Mm-hmm.
And what I've found is if you ask a very open-ended question like, would you like something to drink? You are in for a very long hemming and hawing period. But if you offer two very specific drinks, Diet Coke or one other drink you know they like, you will get an answer.
It's the difference between taking an essay test and a multiple choice test.
Yes.
There's clues in the multiple choice test.
Yes.
You got a blank page for the essay test.
Well, it's funny because I've started getting thank yous from waiters. Recently at a restaurant this past week, I actually had the waiter come up to the table because we go there quite frequently and greet me with, I'm sorry to say we're out of.
To stack the deck in their favor. Or yes. At least simplify the process.
Yes. Yeah. And I'm like, they've caught on. They know what's going on. I'm so grateful.
Well, and that's something that this book, because they were doing it in, frankly, contrived settings, even in the one or two times they actually would do it in, like, in an actual restaurant, pub, whatever, they can't really factor in the reality of particular situations.
Mm-hmm.
The whole, what are you going to have to drink? Take it on an airplane setting. Well, depending where you sit, you may not really have much of a choice because they're not going to say, what would you like? They're going to say, it's what I got left.
Well, and where they were offering the drinks, a pub right off of a college campus. To me, that says young couples, whether they're recently married, early dating.
Or a group of friends. But yeah.
But to me, that's very different than going to somewhere that is popular with the been married 20 years crowd.
Or the office friends crowd. Or retirees or something like that. Well, yes.
One of the examples he gives is a sushi restaurant. And he asks the waiter or waitress.
Oh, yeah.
How often when people come and share a plate of sushi, do you come back to pick it up and there's a single piece of sushi left on the plate?
And the reply was always, every time almost.
Yeah.
Versus, and what was interesting is the author then follows that with the, that's funny because every time I go for sushi by myself, I finish every piece.
Yeah.
And therefore, the only assumption as to why there could be some left is not that people either over-ordered for the full meal or whatever, but that nobody wanted to be taking that last one. He phrased it as, it's communal property.
Yeah.
And therefore, it's violating the social norm to take it. And it's funny because in most of the crowds I've hung out with, and this goes back to college crowds, even work crowds, other social settings and stuff like that, right before that waiter would take that tray, somebody would say, if nobody else is going to take it, I will kind of, do you mind? Because it's like, let's not let it go to waste.
Yeah.
So I do think that because he was asking that as he and other behavioral scientist professors and stuff were having a casual meal.
Yeah.
And I think that's a different setup than hungry students or what have you.
Yeah.
I just never felt that the context was always taken into account.
Yeah. He seemed to think that nobody would ever take the last of a communal resource. I felt that was in several places in the book.
He said that, but then never explained if he thought it was because they didn't feel enough ownership of it or because they feared they would have been treated badly for taking the last one. Because I've been in some situations where I know there was a particular person, again, let's get a rise out of somebody type people, that if you'd taken the last one, they would have called you out on it of how dare you kind of a thing.
But what comes to mind for me with that is, I mean, I go back to the 80s with this. How many times have you gone to a restaurant, there are the glasses for water on the table, and a pitcher, a carafe, whatever, of water, and it's just pass it around or fill your glasses as needed. And like, there was one trip we were on in the 80s, where the glasses are all out, they bring the pitcher of water, it's going around the table, I'm second to last, you're last, pitcher gets to me, and I can tell there's not enough water. Even for my full glass, much less for the both of us.
Yeah.
So I pour half of the water that's in there into my glass and give it to you so you can pour the other half into yours and we can each have some water.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, that was not a matter of, I don't want to take the last of the water. It's, I want you to have some water. But everybody else's attitude was, well, of course they're going to bring more.
Well, one of the things early in that ethics course I took, that the better lecturer of the two was giving that lecture. It's like, okay, guy sees somebody drowning in the water and saves them. Ethically, is that a good or a bad thing? Oh, clearly it's good. Okay, he pulls him out, but he did that because he wanted to shoot him himself. Again, situational.
Yeah.
I'm probably messing the example up. It's been a few years since I was in that college course. But it all comes down to the situational specifics of it.
Mm-hmm.
And taking something out of context and saying it must be for reason A and reason A alone.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one thing to say, hey, reason A is a factor, but it could be B, it could be C, or not even mention B and C. But the minute you start talking in what I consider to be extremist thinking, and I don't think the author got to that point, although definitely leaned in that direction, where I've had encounters with some people where it is either A or not A. There is no middle ground.
Yeah.
And it's like when you get to those sorts of extremists in thought, there's no room for negotiation. Everything is binary, yes or no.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think this is a good book to read, and books of its type, I think, can be very interesting, because I've seen some that are on, again, the paradox of choice. You go down a cereal aisle and you see 50,000 variants of cereal. There comes a point where you look at it. If you put out a display of, okay, I'm going to give you 15 cereals to pick from, which do you like best? Which do you want? People are going to be, oh, I don't know, because it's, well, maybe that one's better and stuff. And he does go in mm-hmm. a bit on the, there's a better option and fear of missing out.
Yeah.
If it's two options, that's pretty easy.
Yeah. Well, and the fear of closing doors.
Fear of closing doors. And there was a section in here on the Pepsi challenge and how Pepsi was saying in a blind taste test, they did better. Meanwhile, Coke was saying in a non-blind taste test, they did better. And again, it goes towards branding and what you bring to it. It's mm-hmm. not just the experience, but what you associate with the experience.
Yeah.
So there are a lot of things in here I found good food for thought. Again, do I buy into all of the conclusions? No. But these were the sorts of things, as I was looking at the sales figures for comics and stuff, which I did for, you know, 15 years on the podcast, and I had been doing it for 7 or 8 before doing it on the podcast. It was always, okay, I'm seeing this change in sales. Either it's shooting up, it's trending down, it's doing no change, whatever. What do I think caused that?
Mm-hmm.
Can I back that up? Does it fit the data?
Mm-hmm.
And there were a number of times where I was able to chart, here is sales of a particular comic that went, you know, X number of years, and it's dropping, okay, change of creative team, bold new direction, boom, it bounces up, and then it trails down, or it doesn't have that, and it trails down, or so many things would follow a particular slope of it.
Yeah.
And then there were a few where they would be telling the same story, even the same creative team, but it's a Marvel title, so every year and a half, we're going to change the name, make it look like a brand new number one. In a few cases, I think Wolverine and the X-Men was a good example. It had 2 volumes of that. The only difference between the end of the one and the start of the next was the new number one.
Mm.
It was mm-hmm. like a continuing story.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, that reset it. It's back in the honeymoon period. Within 4 issues, it's going to drop to this point. And in some cases, many cases, aside from those blips from the artificial bump of the new number one, you see it following the same sales trend.
Yeah.
And there are things where it's like, okay, there's commonality, there's repeatability to this, there is that predictability, which again, what's what this author was going after. It seems irrational, but it's predictable. Why?
Yeah.
And again, whether you agree with the answers he gives, you can see the trending of, yeah, there is something going on there.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that kind of a thing fascinating. And I think that a lot of people don't take the time or don't have the framework to know how to do it, of stepping back, looking at events, trying to figure out the whys behind it without just reading in their biases and stuff like that, but to try to take a little bit more of a look at the empirical evidence
mm-hmm.
and what it leads towards. And I think the more you can do that and the more you can see the same situation from another perspective, in another lens and say, oh, well, it would seem crazy that way, or it makes more sense that way.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's super helpful, because the better you can understand people, the way they act, you can understand situations and either defuse them if you need to.
Yeah.
Or finagle them a little better if you have to, or just accept them more of, yeah, they're going to do this, whether I agree or not. There's a predictability to this other person's behavior, therefore.
Can make life less frustrating.
Or at least more understandable.
Yeah.
Because I've had a few situations, and some very recently as we record this, where somebody did something. I wasn't overjoyed by what they did, but I can see from their perspective why they did it and why they thought it might have even been a really good thing kind of a deal. Whereas if you look at it from another perspective, it seems like a really bad thing. And that's not to say one is right or one is wrong, you know, whatever. And I'm sure there have been other people who've looked at me the same way of, why the hell did John do whatever? So I think, again, the more people think along these lines, the more people do these sorts of studies. You know, what is the impact of a free price? Do placebos work? Is it because of power of suggestion? Is there something else going on?
Mm-hmm.
The better some people can make society, and the more other people can kind of game the system and maybe not make society better.
The other thing he talks about a few times in here is basically the way sales gimmicks, my phrasing, sales gimmicks, can trick us into buying things we don't want to buy, don't mean to buy, that kind of thing.
Well, and it's funny because there were a few places in the book where he commented, even if you know this is happening, it's still effective.
Mm-hmm.
And that line, almost verbatim or whatever, was used in the show.
Yeah.
And just because you're aware of something doesn't mean you become immune to it.
Mm-hmm.
And there are definitely things where a product is marked new and improved, or one of my favorite things is, or favorite examples of this sort of a thing in comics, comic will go along at a particular price point. For whatever reason, they'll do a special, they'll bounce that price point up because it's a double-sized issue, whatever, and then they'll drop that price down. What you don't necessarily notice immediately, because, well, it's cheaper than the last issue. What was $2.99 before, $3.99 before, it went up to $6.99, now it's at $4.99 or something like that.
Yeah.
So they're using the higher price to lower it to a new higher price than it had been prior to the one-time price, but it feels like it's dropped.
Yeah. Well, like, he talks about people who will buy things they don't actually want or need in order to get free shipping. And there again, I'm like,
that was another one I disagreed with him on.
Yeah, I'm like, apparently I am an abnormal person, because at major retailers like Amazon,
yeah,
I keep a wish list of, okay, these are things I want to pick up and I'm budgeting for. And like, when it says, you know, if you spend X more, you'll get the free shipping, I go to that wish list.
Well, I've got a couple of places I've shopped online, and, you know, it's Amazon, it's Target, it's, you know, Walmart, wherever. Some of them, like, I got the Amazon Prime, so it's like, boom, getting the free shipping, that's another. But I've had one or two where there's something I needed more immediately, and it's like, okay, boom, that's going to be X dollars. It's going to cost me $6 in shipping. But there's something else that I do want, don't have to have now, but it's $7.
Yep.
So it's essentially costing me only the dollar more than the shipping would have cost.
Yep.
I'd rather pay for a thing than the service of shipping.
Yeah.
So to me, that's rational.
Yeah.
To him, you're buying something you don't need, clearly.
Mm-hmm.
There's, again, different ways of looking at things.
I had something I needed. Amazon said, spend $5 more or pay $2.99 for delivery tomorrow. I wanted walnuts that were $5.99, and it qualified for the, if you add this, you'll get free delivery tomorrow. I got my walnuts. I didn't pay for my delivery.
The only thing I'm taking out of that story is you got walnuts.
Yes.
And I'll give you a hard time for that after we're done.
Yes, you.
And
I
know exactly
eat walnuts.
Yes, it's.
I can't touch walnut oil. I can
eat walnuts.
That's
the part that was getting me. Okay, just wanted to get that out there.
My allergies are mysterious things.
Yeah, yeah. It's funny because I've had times with the Amazon where, if you're willing to put it off, they'll give you a certain amount of credit or whatever for digital things.
Yes.
And there was a point at which I was racking up a ton of that because it's like, yeah, I need this, but I can wait a week. I don't need it right now.
Now, they realized with me that wasn't always effective, because sometimes the delay honestly wasn't worth it because I did kind of need it. So they switched to offering me an extra 1% back in cash.
That's because of the Amazon credit card you got.
It is.
I didn't have that before I switched to or got that credit card. But this is one of those things where, is it irrational or is there a different mindset you're using?
Mm-hmm.
Do I need it now? Do I not? Can I wait? What's the cost benefit I'm willing to trade off of I need it instantly, therefore I want to pay a higher price for it or not? Or I'm willing to get a bonus to delay getting it or something.
Yeah. Well, and his talk about price anchors I found fascinating.
Yes.
Because my price anchor for certain things is, well, like gasoline. I started driving in the 1990s. Our mother started driving in the 1950s.
Well, I started getting comics. They were 35 cents.
Oh, gosh. Geez. Yeah. Yeah.
Right now, the anchor price is $3.99.
Yeah.
I say right now, by the time this episode goes up, hell, it may be $4.99.
Yeah.
But those things, you get that, this is what the norm is. Is it better than the norm? Is it lower than the norm?
Mm-hmm.
And I've read a number of books on the price of free, some books on branding, and there's so many things that go into how do you finagle the decision process somebody goes through.
When today, I bought some stuff that I knew I wanted to have by the middle of next month. I didn't have to buy it today, just knew when I needed to have it by. But today, A, they were on sale, and B, I had a coupon that would work in conjunction with the sale.
Yes.
So I saved, all said and done, it was something like 40% on the entire purchase.
At one point in comics, there was a lot of discussion around discounting.
Mm.
And there's a lot to be said for, if I know I can get something cheaper. A good example of this right now would be Star Trek ebooks.
Oh, yes.
Every month at Simon & Schuster, they have a selection of Star Trek novels you can get from Amazon Kindle, Barnes & Noble, Books A Million, a few other places for 99 cents that month.
Mm-hmm.
It's good for a couple of weeks. Usually around the end or beginning of the month is when it flips over. So they've essentially trained me to not pay full price for any of their novels.
Yeah.
I just need to be opportunistic. And when I see them at 99 cents, certainly I'll pick them up. A 300-400 page novel for 99 cents, I can swing that. That's a fraction of the price I'm paying for a 20-page comic book these days. And recently I've even bumped it up to, okay, if it's $1.99, I'll go for that. $2.99, no, but $1.99.
Yeah.
Because these are normally $5.99, $6.99, $7.99, $15.99 in some cases. So again, this author might claim, oh, he's buying books he's not going to read, because it's like, I've got a number of these. I haven't read them, I admit that. Now granted, many of these I am buying digital copies of that I have physical book versions that I have read, but there's the convenience factor as well, too, and I would like to reread these. So this is, again, where in my mind, it's a rational thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
In the author's mind, it may seem like a very predictably irrational thing to do. He sees the lower price, he jumps at it.
Yeah. But
I've been able to pick up almost half the Star Trek library of ebooks for a dollar or two each versus the $6, $7, $15 or whatever they're going for.
Yeah. And we do eventually make it through a decent percentage of our to be read list. Not enough, but
I like having things to read versus I'm out. Now I need to get better at prepping the reading list.
Oh, yeah.
For consumption. But that's why when I see something like this, it's a fun thing to read. It's food for thought.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's how to take books like this.
Yes.
Does it give you something to think about? Does it give you a new perspective, new questions to ask? I do not suggest taking books of this ilk as the gospel truth of this is how it is.
Well, I liked what you had to say about the way we rationalize decisions.
Yep.
And I liked what you had to say about sometimes it's just a matter of changing how you think about something, changing your awareness of how you're making some decisions.
Well, and there were a couple of things that made me a little more aware of, yes, I am getting that extra item versus paying the shipping or something of that sort.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the more aware you are of things, kind of the better off you are.
Now, at one point near the end of the book, he was talking about, I want to say it was called Save for Tomorrow.
Oh, about getting people to put more money away.
Yeah.
And there's an amount, there's an aspect of delayed, it's not so much delayed gratification, but delayed pain. If you commit now to save later,
well,
or how
the way went. The way the plan works is you commit now, and you even go so far as to tell your employer, next time I get a raise, I want a percentage of it to go to the 401k.
Mm-hmm.
I want a percentage of it to go to this savings account. And the idea is because you never get that increase in your paycheck, you never see it, you never feel the pain of not having the money and putting it to savings and putting it to the 401k. And part of what I found intriguing and fascinating about is 2 weeks ago, maybe, a friend of mine was saying they'd gotten a pay raise at work and their boss had accidentally told them about it when they didn't mean to. They were planning to surprise them in their paycheck.
Mm.
But because they found out about it before it hit the paycheck, they were able to have a percentage go to their 401k and a percentage go savings. And they figured they'd never miss the money because they never had it in the paycheck.
When I was starting my career, I was obviously not making much.
Mm.
And I got a pay raise at one point. And it was going from, yes, they paid me the minimal amount they possibly could sort of a thing, to they actually were paying me more than that.
Mm.
And it was percentage-wise a significant difference. Dollar-wise, honestly, not that much.
Yeah.
Back
yeah.
in the olden days when they didn't pay people much. But I saw that and I'm like, oh my God, this has to be a mistake, but I'm getting it. And if it's a mistake, it'll clear itself up.
Yeah.
I didn't instigate anything. I haven't done anything wrong. And the person I was working for a little while later, it's like, I was thinking you were going to thank me for
that. Yes, yes.
Again, what you see in the situation depends on your perspective.
Yeah. Well, one of the first jobs I had for a major company, they had a thing you could sign up for when you got the job, where with every paycheck, you got a, I want to say it was a $25 or $50 savings bond.
Mm.
And, you know, they take a billion years to mature. But because that job was going to be paying me significantly more than the previous job I'd had,
yeah,
I went ahead and signed up for it.
I think the smartest thing people entering the workforce can do, and it's smart, but it's damn hard. Put as much as you can into a 401k, into a savings thing. Save as much as you possibly can.
Mm-hmm.
But at that point, most people are paying off student debt. They're having to set up a house or an apartment or living things, paying for a car, insurance. I mean, it's hard to have the money to do that with.
The thing I learned in my 20s from watching coworkers was when you get the form that says, how much do you want to have withheld? I had some coworkers, because again, the dark ages, we had a job where they were being paid in cash. I was on direct deposit. They were being paid in cash on Fridays and they had zero withholding.
Mm.
I had a different job, a coworker who figured out how to have minimal withholding. It was like you could have up to 10 points or as little as 1 point. And she figured out how to get only 1 point. And in both cases, when tax time came around,
you get nailed if you're not careful. Yeah.
The people who were paid in cash every Friday and had zero withholding, I knew people who had to actually go get a job to earn the money to pay the taxes on the job we've been working.
It's easy to get into that situation. And again, the more you can sock away, the more you can get withheld, all that kind of thing, the better off you are. It's easy to say that. It's hard to do that if you don't have the cash flow or whatever. And I say that as somebody who's admittedly not so great spending habits.
Well, I think Dan Ariely puts it in here of, you know, we all say we can meet a deadline. It's hard to meet a deadline, especially a self-imposed one. And in the cases of the taxes, it's the, we all think we can save or set aside X amount of money by X date. And heaven forbid you need a rainy day fund.
Yeah, you had an unexpected expense. But he treated deadlines as if they're all equal.
Yes.
And one of the takeaways I had from getting things done is you can always renegotiate the deadlines you set for yourself.
Yes. That was something I learned in college.
And there are pros and cons to learning that.
Yeah.
Because I'll admit, like with the podcast, there are some things, it's like, yep, I've got to have this episode up by Monday or there's no episode. Got to get that done. There are others, I'm working ahead, so I don't have to work as hard on that necessarily. I can put that off if there's something I'd rather do or if I'm just tired or whatever.
Yeah.
So there's a certain amount of self-discipline and, again, understanding when are you procrastinating, why are you procrastinating, and things like that. Because there's also, I think, in this day and age, a rampant culture of uber productivity. If you're not doing something, you're wasting your life. You're not spending every moment productive.
We're a culture of multitasking. How many people are watching a TV, movies, whatever screen, and tweeting, and whatever else they're doing?
It's easy to fall into that trap.
Mm-hmm.
And there are some things where the best thing you can do sometimes is just take some downtime.
Yeah.
Just kick back, watch some TV, or take a nap, or read a book, or whatever. And there are other times where, as much as you may need that, you do got something in a hard deadline.
Yeah.
But I think part of that is, again, planning ahead and things of that sort. But that's where I would like to see the behavioral scientists go through things like getting things done and some of the other productivity mm-hmm. systems that are popular, put them to the test, do personality profiles on a significant number of people, have them use the systems, how well did they adhere to them, how well did it work, things of that sort. Because again, it's not one size fits all.
Yeah.
Some people are going to think more of a mindset that do certain ways, or some of these systems are going to be prejudiced from the era in which they were invented.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things about the original getting things done system was the 43 folders.
Oh, yeah.
And Dad had these. You've got 12, one for every month. You've got 31, one for every day.
Mm-hmm.
And you're just kind of rotating them through and you've already, you know, you've got stuff.
It's funny you mentioned those. Our dad passed away in January. And I went into his, he called it his tickle file.
January many years ago.
Just yes. Yes. Sorry. January over 5 years ago. But I went through his tickle file at one point just to make sure there wasn't something that he had a deadline on or something that needed to be done. And when I got to September, I found he had already bought a birthday card for you that year.
I remember that. It was a little weird, but nice to be getting for my 50th birthday.
Yeah.
When my dad had passed away, better part of a year earlier.
Yeah.
And again, some people are wired to do things ahead of time.
He'd seen the right card. He'd picked it up. He'd put it in the file where he'd known where it would be. And our dad's organizational skills, frankly, are something I wish I'd inherited.
That's the kind of thing, by the time you realize you really need them, the people you'd want to get them from aren't always around to ask.
Yeah.
And I know I was given various pieces of advice as to how to take notes, how to do things and stuff like that when I was a kid.
Mm-hmm.
And it was completely wasted on me. And it was never explained, this is why you do it this way. It was somebody's way of doing it. It worked for them. Ergo, it works for everybody.
Yes.
And again, one of the big takeaways, I think, for me from this kind of a book is certain things work for certain people. Certain people think in certain ways and are going to act certain ways behind it. But everybody is different. You know, understand how you work. Understand how the people around you work and think and act accordingly.
One of the chapters that I highlighted a fair amount in, chapter 10, the effect of expectations.
Mm.
I think that's something that we've danced around in a lot of our podcasts in terms of, we had high expectations coming into this movie, and that's why we either did or didn't like something.
I did an episode eons ago on spoilers, I'm against them.
Mm-hmm.
And defining a spoiler for some people is something you need to do, because some people, well, it's a 10-year-old story. It's not a spoiler. Well, I haven't read everything that came out in the last year, much less the last 10 years or even the last 20 years.
Yeah.
There's a lot of stuff out there. Again, this is a book we're doing from 2009.
Yeah.
And that's why at the beginning of these sorts of episodes, spoiler-filled discussion, you're warned. But other people think, saying, oh, it's the best thing ever, best movie of the year, it's perfect. Oh, it's not a spoiler, I didn't tell you anything specific. Well, you set my expectations.
Yes.
I'm more likely to go into that thinking, is it really all of that? Likewise, if somebody says, oh god, this had no redeeming qualities, why did they release it? It was complete garbage. I'm going to go in thinking, well, is it really that bad?
Mm-hmm.
And I always try to differentiate what I enjoy versus what I think is good.
Yes.
Because I can enjoy movies that are predictable, unoriginal, maybe even not even perfectly or even well executed, but entertaining in some way.
Mm-hmm.
And others that they're really perfect at their craft, and that's why I hate them.
Yeah.
You know, a good horror film is that way for me.
Yeah. You know,
just not for me. But when you go in with preconceived notions, and for me, story spoilers are one of the rudest, meanest things you can do to the storyteller.
Yes.
Because you are stealing their thunder. You are taking their hard work, grabbing the end result, the pearl or jewel of it or whatever, and then unceremoniously dumping it in front of somebody, sans context, build up, and all of that, and in some cases, very much ruining the experience of the story.
I told Mom one day that I was headed into my office and I was going to watch a certain TV show. And she said, oh, I hear so-and-so is guest starring on it. And I'm like, and thank you for ruining that.
I had a coworker who we shared an office, and he started a conversation one morning with, I can't believe they killed thus and so.
Oh, yeah.
What did you think of that? And my response was, well, it's 9:15 in the morning. The comic book store doesn't open until noon. The issue comes out today.
Yeah.
I haven't read it. I don't know. You know what I mean? But now I know going in.
Yeah.
And this is something that the entire issue was going on one story, and then on the last page, they kind of pivot to that. And I've had some movies I've gone through knowing somebody was going to show up, somebody was going to die, something was going to happen or whatever, but not knowing exactly when or whatnot. And I spent the entire time second-guessing, is it now, is it now, is it now?
Yeah, yeah.
And it's the reverse of the dancing gorilla video.
Mm-hmm.
You've got people, they're bouncing basketballs around, passing them around, and you're told to watch, and how many times does the blue team pass the basketball? You're sitting there counting it, okay, is it 15, 16, 17, okay, it's done. And you get asked, okay, what did you think of the gorilla? And you're like, what gorilla? You watch the video again, boom, there's a gorilla walking straight through, but you were so focused.
Yeah.
And setting expectations, giving spoilers, things of that sort. And there were a number of times they used that effect in the setup of their experiments in this book.
Mm-hmm.
Of, we asked them how many of the Ten Commandments could they remember, or reminded them this thing is under part of the MIT honor code system, which didn't exist at the time, at least. And therefore, they're thinking now in terms of more ethical behavior, whether they realize it or not.
Yeah.
Versus this other group, we told them to name 10 TV shows or something like that.
Yeah.
And therefore, we get different results. Ergo, it must be because.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly there's some justification of, okay, they thought of the Ten Commandments. They're thinking potentially a little more ethically, or maybe they're just a more honest group of students. Don't know.
Yeah.
They spent no effort to get some kind of barometer on that.
I agree.
So, yeah, these are the kinds of books I find fascinating and sometimes frustrating.
Yeah.
Because I'll be thinking, yep, agree, and oh, yeah, totally disagree.
Well, on the placebo experiment, they exposed them to pain for that's what the medication was supposed to help for. And my thing with that was my first session of chemo felt like my worst because I didn't know what to expect. I didn't know if I was properly prepared. I was so nervous. Now, no session of chemo was great. But let's keep in mind that for 2 days prior to chemo, they give you steroids that make it hard to sleep, that make you kind of jumpy. You're
already miserable to begin with.
You know, so there is very much a how'd they prime that particular pump. So with the pain experiment, I found myself wondering, okay, you've just gone through the pain. They offer you a medication, but you also know what you're about to experience. Are you better prepared to deal with it now that you know what it is?
Well, I think one of the things they did for that kind of experiment, according to the book, was, you know, put your hand in ice cold water.
That was for the, do you want pain medication when you have a baby?
But it was yes. Measuring pain. I had seen a series that Stephen Fry did, I think, on language. And that particular chunk or section of one of the episodes was around profanity. Does using it help when dealing with pain? So it was him and Brian Blessed.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd put their fist in this freezing water and profanity. Sure enough, it helps or whatever. And I hear about things like that, those sorts of experiments, and having seen one on TV and such. I know in many respects, I am an outlier in many areas. And pain is something that is, I think, intrinsically impossible to have an empirical scale on.
I agree.
Because I know our mother, when she's getting her blood drawn, the act of the needle coming near her seems to give her true physical pain.
Yes.
Before it even touches her.
She flinches before it touches her.
And not just in anticipation, but you know, last time I had blood drawn for a blood test or whatever, I warned them. It's like, I don't like looking. And they're like, well, you're going to faint. You're going to pass. No, I just don't like doing it. You know, it was kind of funny. But for like this pain thing, I feel I am an outlier in that respect, having had a birth defect where when I was a kid, if I would twist my arm, there are two bones in the arm, I would have a nerve that would get pinched between them.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the first thing you're going to do when you hit that kind of a pain is stop moving.
Yes, and keep it pinched.
And keep it pinched, which really hurts. So it's like if you bang your arm and you hit your funny bone or whatever, that kind of a pain that you feel for a split second, imagine that lasting for a prolonged length of time on a recurring basis. So again, what I consider to be, yes, that's uncomfortable, but is it excruciating pain or whatever? I've got a different scale.
Mm-hmm.
It's like people in some part of the world, what they consider spicy and mild, my range of, oh my God, spicy is within their, it's not even mild yet category.
Yeah.
It's just, it's exponent range kind of a deal. So again, trying to generalize things is a dicey thing. I mean, you need to do it for this sort of stuff to get some operating parameters, to get some theories and things of that sort. But again, that's why I keep saying these are the sorts of books that are good to read for food for thought, things to think about, theories to give consideration to, but not, hey, the guy said if people order aloud, they're going to act this way, therefore.
Yeah.
Because maybe it was true for the 30 students he did it with or 100 students or whatever, but can you really extrapolate that to all of humanity? And if it was true 25 years ago, is it still true today, given changes in society?
Mm-hmm.
So, again, I found it a fascinating book. Some chapters I like better than others, and I could definitely see having read this where somebody was thinking, this would be an interesting protagonist for procedural. I think with the irrational Jesse L. Martin, I'm sure he's read the book.
Yeah.
I'd be shocked and disappointed if he had not. I don't think he is trying to be the author, but he is trying to portray a character that has that curiosity, is in a position to run those sorts of experiments, to draw out conclusions, and to rethink them when needed.
Yes.
So I think of all the shows I have watched where it was based on a book, this is the one where it was the most, I don't want to say tenuous, but most unusual, inspired by situation.
Mm-hmm.
But also one of the ones where I think it rang true to the source material, even though the source material is not fictional, it is not a procedural, it is something totally different, but it definitely, I see what they pulled out of it and why and how to build that show. And I think it gives that show a very good framework.
I agree.
And it makes me wonder with like numbers, if there was a similar grounding or not for that show. And I don't think there was.
Not that I'm aware of.
But yeah, it's interesting stuff.
I definitely recommend giving it a read and taking a little time to think about it in relation to yourself.
Yeah, this is a good book to read a chapter at a time, give it a little thought, percolate on it, and not just try to plow through it cover to cover or whatnot, because there's a lot in there. And the author is upfront in a number of places. He's generalizing, he's simplifying, he's, you know, he's not trying to declare this to be the be-all, end-all truth, although his writing style is that way.
Yes.
So, anything else?
I think that does it.
Cool.
The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. Please email us at theguys@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.